Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today on Studio Tulsa, our longtime book reviewer Nancy Pearl gives us some great suggestions for summer reading. Whether you love novels, mysteries, history, biographies, or speculative fiction, Nancy has some great recommendations for some good reading while you're on holiday or downtime this summer, or just a way to spend a long summer evening. Nancy Pearl began reviewing books here at KWGS back in 1990 while a librarian in the Tulsa City County system. She continued after moving to Seattle, where she ran the Washington Center for the Book at the public library there. There she came up with the very first One City, One Book citywide reading program back in 1998. She's the author of several books about books in her Book Lust series, a novel, George and Lizzie, and her most recent, The Writer's Library, a book taken from her television work interviewing authors for the Seattle channel there about the writers most important to authors in their own work. Today, she joins us with some great summer reading suggestions on Studio Tulsa. Well, this time we're talking about good beach reads or summertime reading. And this list is really interesting. It's got something for any type of reader. And perhaps for those who follow current events, your first title might be a wonderful salve at this particular point. Tell us about Peter Kanellis's The Great Dissenter.
So The Great Dissenter is Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan. The subtitle is John Marshall Harlan, America's Judicial Hero. And it's a fascinating, big, thick, lose yourself in this biography of this very interesting man. He served for 34 years on the court from 1877 to 1911. And he dissented in three big cases, actually six cases, because we talk about the civil rights cases of 1883. We generally refer to them as one case, but they were three separate cases. John Marshall Harlan was named for the great Supreme Court Justice John Marshall, which is so ironic. He grew up in a family that owned slaves. He was a slaveholder. He didn't have any problem with that. And then he was put on the Supreme Court, and he had a change of heart, a change of mind. He started to see things in the light of the Constitution in a different way from everyone else on the court. In these dissents that he did, I think in four of the six, he was the only person who dissented. And the biggest case that he dissented in was Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 case that established the infamous separate but equal way of looking at race relations. And he became just an advocate, went from being an advocate of the institution of slavery to becoming a strong proponent of the Union and the defender of First Amendment rights. People can change, and they can change in really basic ways, and they can understand things differently than they did. I think that that's really important, and maybe that's something, Rich, that, you know, is comforting me a little bit during these trying times, although I don't see any sign of that yet on these current Supreme Court justices. And looking back at the Constitution, really what he was trying to do was understand what the signers of the Constitution, you know, what they meant, the founders of our country meant, especially in terms of race and especially in terms of that, you know, what the First Amendment means.
And, you know, of course, the old saw about dissents, in which, you know, of course, John Marshall Harlan penned some very famous dissents, is today's dissent might be tomorrow's majority. And, you know, and I think we're actually witnessing that today because, you know, Clarence Thomas, regardless of your opinion, he was a dissenter for a long time. And now today he's authoring majority opinions because the pendulum swings back and forth. So generally tomorrow's majority opinion will, quote, a dissent from the past.
Yes. You know, the sense you get in this book is that there's a possibility that change is possible and that his, you know, staunch defense of the First Amendment was so powerful to read about. And of course, they didn't have Twitter or Facebook, So, you know, possibly it was not as well known as People's Dissent or Writing for the Majority is now. But you can't read this book without really admiring him.
That's Peter Kanellos's The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero. Well, from that, we go to a very interesting novel by Marianne Cronin titled The 100 Years of Lenny and Margot. And Lenny and Margot together add up to 100 years, very opposite parts of the age spectrum, but they become friends. Tell us about this novel.
Yes. So 17-year-old Lenny lives in a Glasgow hospital, the section for the terminally ill. You know, she's 17. She has this incurable disease. She's alone in the hospital because her mother, who was Swedish, returned to Sweden. And her father tells her, and this is something that I think would be interesting to discuss in a book group. Her father tells her that it's too painful for him to visit her. And he will come back when she's dying, you know, in her final days. That's hard for a parent to hear, I think, or to read. It was certainly hard for me to read. But Lenny says to him, that's fine. And Lenny creates her own, a new family with some of the friends that she makes in the hospital, including the chaplain, the hospital chaplain, Father Arthur, who, you know, who deals with his strong beliefs and Lenny's, you know, caustic wit about religion and various things. But the most important person probably that she meets is Margot. And Margot is 83. And as you said, their combined ages add up to 100. And they meet in an art class and they decide they're going to paint 100 pictures from their lives. And so the book is the story of their lives, especially Margot's life, because she's had many more years. You know, sometimes you just feel like you need a cleansing weep over a book. That's fine to read a sad book because you need to cry. And that's what I've heard from so many people that I recommended this book to. Yeah, it's sad, but there's such life in it, and the characters are so real, and there's so much to talk about. I mean, I mentioned one aspect of the book that I thought would be good for book discussions, but there's another interesting piece of it, which is that Margot's husband makes a very interesting decision, and that decision, I think, would lead to some really interesting discussions. So if you're looking for a good book club book, I think this is it.
Marianne Cronin's The 100 Years of Lenny and Margot. Well, the next book takes a real life incident that happened in the 1920s and reimagines what happened during that particular event. It's titled The Christie Affair. Tell us about The Christie Affair.
So, Rich, I loved this book. This was probably my favorite book of the whole spring season. In 1926, Agatha Christie, who was already a well-known, very popular writer of mysteries, she had already invented Hercule Poirot, for example. In 1926, she learned that her husband was having an affair and wanted a divorce. And what she did one night was sneak out of the house where she was living with her husband and her child and her little dog. She left it all behind and disappeared. Her car was found by the same river, the Ouse, in which Virginia Woolf drowned herself. And the car was abandoned by that river. So, you know, the general thought was that she had killed, that Agatha Christie had killed herself. But nobody knows what really happened. No one. I mean, there have been so many books, both fiction and nonfiction, purporting to have the answer of what happened for those 11 days that Agatha Christie disappeared. Because after 11 days, she reappeared at a country inn, and then life went on. But those 11 days, so that is what The Christie Affair by Nina de Grammont is about. And what I loved about this book is the decision that the author made to tell the story from the point of view of the husband's mistress. And so we see the events, and of course they're all made up because nobody knows, but we see the events that this author thinks happened from the point of view of that young woman. And one of the facts that we do know about Agatha Christie's disappearance is that the country inn where she was found, she had registered under her husband's lover's name. Isn't that amazing? So that's one of the things that we know. This is such a wonderful novel. And the even better part is that the plot of the book itself is like an Agatha Christie mystery.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's incredibly well done. The Christie Affair is by Nina de Grammont. Now, the next book is another one that I think it might be a little too soon for people really to jump into this, perhaps. It's Charles Finch, What Just Happened? Notes on a Long Year. And of course, the long year in question is 2020.
So when I first saw this book, I thought, there is no way that I'm going to read a book about the first year of the pandemic. You know, we've just lived through it, and I don't need to revisit any of it. And then I picked it up because Charles Finch writes a series of mysteries, of Victorian mysteries, and I've enjoyed them. And I know from reading those mysteries that he's a very good writer. So I started reading What Just Happened, which is his diary for a year. And it didn't upset me in the way that I thought that it would. What I appreciated so much about Charles Finch is how smart he is, how intelligent he is, how humorous he is. But this is a book that, because he's so smart, he can really do a lot of zingers that I quite appreciated. Mm.
And of course, it's not only about the pandemic, but it's also about the rest of the events of the year.
Yes.
George Floyd, you have the election and the aftermath of the election. So, I mean, he's talking about lots of things that, you know, just made 2020 absolutely bananas year. In so many ways, and so devastating to so many people. The name of the book is What Just Happened? Notes on a Long Year by Charles Finch. Now, the next book sounds like a really good beach read, Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. And it sounds like it's got this nice little hook at the end for what seems like a straightforward premise. Tell us about this book.
Yeah, so this is Bonnie Garmus's first novel. She's in her 50s, maybe early 60s. And Lessons in Chemistry, I would agree with you, is a great beach read, except it's still just in hardback. So I take care of it if you're at the beach, not get it too wet or sandy. The main character is a young woman named Elizabeth Zott, who is a chemist. And she gets a job in a lab and is in search of beakers. There aren't enough beakers in her lab, in her research lab. So she goes searching for some beakers that she can put in her lab. And by doing that, she meets another chemist, and the two eventually get married, have a child. But things happen, as we all know, things happen in life. And Elizabeth Zott turns from her career in chemistry to doing a TV show on cooking. But rather than it being cooking, what she's really doing is teaching chemistry.
Food chemistry.
All of these housewives. This is set in the 1960s. And she's teaching chemistry to all of these housewives, which is just a wonderful, wonderful novel. If you're a dog lover, one of the best dogs in fiction that I've encountered in a long time is this stray dog that Elizabeth and her husband adopt. And the dog's name is 630, because that was the time that Elizabeth found the dog. and the dog, oh my gosh, this is such a wonderful book. It's fun. It's, you know, it's about life. Elizabeth Zott's husband is a rower, And Elizabeth learns how to row. So, you have to imagine, because it gives such a realistic picture of what rowers go through to get their bodies ready for rowing. You have to imagine that Bonnie Garmus is a rower as well. Yeah, I love this book.
And without giving too much away, yes, she's teaching the people watching the cooking show about chemistry, as she's teaching food chemistry, if you will. But she's also
Right.
teaching the viewers about what their limits are and what they can do and what people say they can't do that
Right.
perhaps they can as well. So,
Yes.
yeah.
Yeah. And I think, remembering that it was in the 60s and, we women were searching for ways of self-expression, stymied by what they could or could not do. The glass ceiling was certainly real then. If it's not real now, that's still a question. And Elizabeth Zott, by empowering the women who watch her on the show, and nobody believes the show would be a success. There's some wonderful scenes with the people who run the TV station that she's on. Yeah, great book.
That's Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry. And now the next book's by Irish musician Ronan Heshin. It's titled Leonard and Hungry Paul. This sounds like a pretty contemplative novel.
This is a quiet novel. It's about two men in their 30s, Leonard and Hungry Paul, longtime friends. They both live with their parents. It's a first novel. It was the choice last year for Dublin Reads, one Dublin, one book, and which is how I discovered it. As you said, the author, the Irish author, is a singer, a songwriter. He's known, his performing name is Mumblin' Deaf Row. So both Leonard and Hungry Paul are really introverts, and their friendship is it really sustains them. And things happen in the novel. Leonard meets a woman that he likes. Hungry Paul wins a contest, and their lives change. But they're still the same people that they are. They're introverts and always will be introverts. What I loved about this book, a couple of things. One is that the author, Ronan Heshin, never tells us why Hungry Paul's name is Hungry Paul. We just accept that it is. And the other thing is that the writing is absolutely lovely. And I'm just going to quick read just a sentence or two from the book. Leonard was raised by his mother alone with cheerfully concealed difficulty, his father having died tragically during childbirth. Though she was not by nature the soldiering type, she taught him to look at life as a daisy chain of small events, each of which could be made manageable in its own way. She was a person for whom kindness was a very ordinary thing, who believed that the only acceptable excuse for not having a bird feeder in the back garden was that you had one in the front garden. Isn't that great?
That's nice. And I guess a lot of their meetings take place in a pub, is that right?
They do meet in a pub, but they also meet at Hungry Paul's house in the basement play. So they play, not computer games, but games.
Yeah. It's a Ronan Heshin's Leonard and Hungry Paul. Well, next on the list is Laird Hunt's Zori.
Oh my goodness, this is a beautiful, beautiful book. This is a quiet book as well, and it's the story of a woman's life, of Zori's life, growing up during the Depression through the events of the 20th century. It reminded me a little bit of Stone Diaries by Carol Shields, which is another quiet book about a woman's life. The writing in this book is very plain, as Zori herself is very plain. And it's everyday writing. You're not going to find any words in here that feel you need to look up, or you're not going to be put off by the flowery prose. This is just plain everyday writing, but it becomes so beautiful in Laird Hunt's hands. This novel was a finalist for the 2021 National Book Awards. I am so grateful that I found this book, because what I thought about after I finished it was that every life contains multitudes. And even though you don't ever become a Supreme Court justice or marry a Supreme Court justice or do anything that's going to change history, your life contains multitudes. I loved it.
Yeah, it touches many people. That's right. That's Laird Hunt's Zori. The next book, my guest, by the way, is Nancy Pearl, our longtime book reviewer here on Studio Tulsa, with some summer reading suggestions. And the next book is a series of stories by Gish Jin. It's titled Thank You, Mr. Nixon. And it's kind of a very broad premise for these interconnected stories. And that is Mr. Nixon opened China in the early 1970s. And all of the stories have some connection to the fact that China opened up to the West and the rest of the world.
So this is really, although it is short stories, a collection of interrelated short stories about Chinese families and Chinese American families. You can read this as a novel because there's an arc, because the stories are connected in such a way that it comes to a conclusion in the last story. So if you think that short stories are not your thing, I'd say give this a try. Gish Jin, I've been a big fan of Gish's books ever since her early books. So the first story in this book is the title story, Thank You, Mr. Nixon. And it's a letter from a young Chinese woman, well, an elderly now Chinese woman in heaven. And she's writing to Richard Nixon, who is in hell, I believe pit A of hell. And she's writing to thank him for coming to China, to open up China. Now, why was that so important? It was so important because he not only came, but he brought his wife, Pat Nixon, and she was wearing a beautiful red coat. And as a result of seeing that red coat, this Chinese family, led by this woman who's now in heaven, went into the coat making business. And that sets the family on this path that we read about through this book. It's funny, it's moving, it's insightful. It's all of those things, but most of all, it's such a pleasure to read.
That's Gish Jin's Thank You, Mr. Nixon. We have just a couple of books left. Next is a really interesting premise, Julie Otsuka's The Swimmers. And it's a group of swimmers who don't know each other necessarily, but they meet at a university swimming pool until they can't meet at the swimming pool anymore. And we learn about one character in particular.
Yes. This is Julie Otsuka's third novel. Her second novel, which I highly, highly, highly recommend, called The Buddha in the Attic. But The Swimmers is, I really think about it as two novellas. I mean, it's a very short book. And the novellas, of course, are even shorter. But the two novellas, the first novella is, as you said, Rich, a group of swimmers who have come together. And it's written in the first person plural. We did this, you know, we thought this. And of course, their lives, these are dedicated like daily swimmers. And they're known by Ron and Line in Lane 5, for example, that kind of description, because they don't know each other outside of the swimming. When the pool closes because it needs repairs, you know, their lives are kind of thrown into disarray. And we get to meet, we have met her in that first section about the swimmers, but then we get to meet and come in close contact with an elderly swimmer who is falling into dementia. And that is told as you, and the you is addressed to the woman's daughter, who has somewhat been estranged from her family and now must take care of her mother. I mean, this was so beautiful. And a doctor I know read this book, a neurologist read this book, and said that the picture of the place where this woman is living, this, you know, home for people who have lost cognitive abilities, who are suffering from dementia, is so real. And her experience, the main character's experience, is so real. I think what Julie Otsuka can do in these is really get you inside of the characters. The Buddha in the Attic is also written from the point of view of, is written for in the first person plural, and it's about, begins with the picture brides, the young women coming over from Japan to marry men who have paid for their passage to the United States. And what happens when World War II breaks out and the Japanese are interned in prison camps. And the last chapter of The Buddha in the Attic is written in the we, but the we is no longer the Japanese characters. The we that it's written from the point of view of are the people who have been left behind, the Caucasian men and women and families in the towns where these Japanese were taken away from.
Sounds like a really interesting premise and book. Both books are really interesting. The one we talked about today is The Swimmers by Julie Otsuka. Time for one last book, and that is This Time Tomorrow by Emma Straub.
Yeah, I loved this book. This is, I don't know whether it's going to be reviewed as a time travel book. I didn't think of it that way, although there is time travel in this book. I thought of this book as really the story of a father and a daughter who really loves her father and doesn't want him to die. So, it's the eve of the main character Alice's 40th birthday the next day. And, she has a pretty good life. She has a best friend. They've been best friends forever. She has a job that's okay, but her father is in the hospital and quite ill. And when Alice wakes up on the day of her birthday, she discovers she is back on her 16th birthday. And she has to decide what she could change in her life so that her father wouldn't be in the position that he's in.
Yeah. And she has a chance to change things and see her father in a new light from the 40-year-old character.
Yep. Yeah. Yes.
Sounds really interesting. This Time Tomorrow by Emma Straub. Well, Nancy, as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for your time and have a wonderful summer of reading.
Thank you, Rich. It's always a pleasure to talk to you too.
Our longtime book reviewer and America's librarian, Nancy Pearl, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa with some great summer reading suggestions. If you missed some of the titles on the books, we have all the information on our website at publicradiotulsa.org. Just click the Studio Tulsa link. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Hope you have a wonderful 4th of July holiday, and thanks for listening.